Good evening.
Good evening.
Welcome. So I'm walking up a rocky hill, Cottonwood Hills, Joshua Tree National Park, in the southern part of the park. I'm walking over and under boulders, feeling my muscles stabbed by yucca, grabbed by thorns, just feeling the dust and the heat. This is about a little over a month ago. And I had some instructions from the guides of this program that I was doing. And basically, the instructions were, go out onto the land, walk out into the world, be open, be vulnerable, and let yourself be drawn to a being. This could be a plant, an animal, a rock, but it could also be a quality of light, or a dark place, or the wind, or a cloud, just some presence that you feel. And when you find that presence, sit down and offer it your attention. And sit open with this presence. And attend to the relationship. Consider, what is this being in relationship with? What is it like to be this being? So I did that, accepted that instruction. And after, 45 minutes or so, I found myself sitting inside a rock. It was an amazing, huge, 20-foot big old rock that had a place carved inside it, so you could literally go sit inside. It was like being in a throne and looking out this rock window out at the world. And when I sat and I considered what rock is in relationship to, what I realized, what I heard, what I felt, was rock is really defined a lot by what has been stripped away, by the elements. What makes a rock is the wind, is erosion, is the time it spent under the earth in fire, is earthquake, is mineral. This is what rock is, the bones of the earth. And I felt this profound affinity. Thought, yeah, you know, I know what that feels like to be eroded and to be pulled into the earth and be transformed by fire. So then the next week, I was in the Aravaipa Canyon in southeastern Arizona, engaging in similar activity, but this time the being was a saguaro. And I don't know if you've ever really hung out with saguaro cactus. This was my first real encounter with saguaro. They're big. It's really, 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 really tall. And they're old. They're hundreds of years old, these cactus in the Sonoran Desert. So this time, when I was attending to the relationship and listening with my heart to this being, I actually felt like, oh, you're an ancestor. I know you. You're an ancestor. And then I took the liberty of asking myself, which ancestor might you be? And I heard, ah, Mahapajapati. Okay. Oh, Mahapajapati, what is it that you have to teach me? What is it that Mahapajapati had to teach us, the first woman ancestor, the woman who was the aunt of the Buddha, and who, when Buddha's mother died when he was a baby, she suckled him, she raised him. And when he came back as a great teacher, she wanted to practice with him, and he was kind of resistant with her about women practicing at the level that men practiced, but she persisted until she prevailed. So this is Mahapajapati. So there I was saying, okay, Mahapajapati, what is it? What are the qualities that you want me to attend to? And she said, devotion, clarity, persistence, not waiting for permission to preach the Dharma, community support, advocacy, activism, and generosity. So I pondered if I should begin my talk by telling you these things, because I thought, uh-oh, here she goes again. Crazy, crazy Myoka Ganmon, crazy monk Ganmon out on another desert trip, talking to the cactus, talking to the rocks. When I've shared such things before from this seat, there's been a fair question that I've been asked is, aren't you just making all this stuff up in your head? Because, of course, rocks and cactus don't talk, right? And it is true that we are making it all up. We can only perceive from our mental structure that we have. And we are all in skin bags, and we are all with these minds that invent the world. So it's true. I will confess, I will own up to that. I make that stuff up. And yet, the great and yet also of Zen, always the two truths. And yet, this skin bag, was created by and only exists through relationship with the other. This is where we come from. This is how we evolve. Often when we think about evolution, we think about the story of survival of the fittest. That's one of the stories of evolution and natural selection. Very popular story, an accurate story, but there's other stories, more contemporary stories, stories of symbiosis, that we actually evolved because organisms consumed each other and became each other and lived in intricate, intermeshed life with each other. One of the proponents of this biological theory, Lynn Margulis, proposed that we evolved primarily through symbiosis, something that a wonderful professor at UCSC called Donna Haraway, that Lori turned me on to, she described this other story of evolution as sensual molecular curiosity, irresistible attraction toward enfolding each other, is the vital motor of living and dying on Earth. So yeah, we're separate. Yeah, we have minds. Yeah, we make stuff up. And we wouldn't exist if not for this complete interconnected relationship that we have with other. There's a he's a philosopher a cultural ecologist and a performance artist. His name is David Abram. And he has a book called The Spell of the Sensuous that came out a while ago. And this is something that he said. And I think about this when I think about this experience of really being with other. And I know I'm talking about rock and cactus, but I also include human other in this wonderful way that we can be present for one another and attend to the relationship, pay attention, give our attention to our absolute interdependence. He says, the human mind is not some otherworldly essence that comes to house itself inside our physiology. Rather, it is instilled and provoked by the sensorial field itself, induced by the tensions and participations between the human body and the animate earth. It is not a self-enclosed object, but an open, incomplete entity. All the different pathways of the senses continually open outward from the perceiving body. We might think of the sensing body as a kind of open circuit that completes itself only in things and in the world. So there was this term that they used in this course that I took. It was called Deep Imagination from the Animus Valley Institute, the group I've studied with when I go do these activities now for some years. They called it participatory consciousness. And I think that's a really interesting concept to consider. It's more than a concept. It's the recognition that we are co-creating even our consciousness. Because as David Abram said, our mind is not an otherworldly essence that comes to house itself inside our physiology. Our mind literally became mind, our individual mind and our human mind, through interaction with the sensorial field. The pathways of the senses continually open outward from the perceiving body. We might think of the sensing body as a kind of open circuit that completes itself only in things and in the world. Where have I heard this before? Well, I've read it in my journals, and I've read it in these evolutionary philosophical things, but there's somewhere else I've heard this before. Oh, there's a guy called Suzuki Roshi. Heard of him? Here's something he said. He said, enlightenment comes from all things to us. All the different pathways of the senses. Oh, excuse me, I skipped up. Darn. Enlightenment comes from all things to us. When we attain enlightenment, everything comes. This is not the same as intellectual experience in which I understand something. In direct experience, it means a truth came to me. And there's, to me, this is none other than what Dogen calls being actualized by the myriad things, which is one of my favorite lines of Dogen's, and it's one of my favorite lines in Buddhism. And why I like it is because I find it to be a very helpful, specific instruction that helps relieve suffering. And that's what I'm interested in, because I suffer a lot, and I know a lot of us suffer a lot, and I'm very interested in what are teachings that can help relieve suffering, and this is one that I think can, being actualized by the myriad things. Because he's telling us in this sentence, which is actually in the middle of a longer teaching that I will also talk about, but he's telling us that, you know, It's a way to move in the world, and it's something that we can do with this mind of ours, which is the source of our suffering. I mean, and by suffering, I'm not talking about, like, you know, if a boulder falls on your foot and breaks your leg and you're in pain. I'm not saying that kind of suffering. That's just pain. You know, stuff happens and it hurts. I'm not talking about that. That's not what I mean by suffering. By suffering, what I mean is kind of my understanding of how we talk about it in Buddhism, which is the self-generated suffering, or what they call the second arrow. The first arrow is the one that life shoots at you. Oh, can't do anything about that. But then what do you do with the arrow? You know, do you pull it out and give it another stab? And then do you think about it and you toss and you turn about it? You know, that's the suffering. So this primary suffering that we have of the subject-object dualism. You know, and in a way, we can't escape it, because again, we are skin bags, we are in our own bodies, we do have separateness, and yet, the beauty of the Buddha Dharma is that it's offering us, there's a different way to think about it. We don't have to just be locked into completely, fully, 100% living and believing in this subject-object dualism that is such a source of suffering. Do you know what I mean when I talk about the suffering of subject-object dualism? Is there anybody? Raise your hand if you're kind of like, huh? What do you think she means? Okay, good. I'm going to say a little more about that. All right. So, real specifically, okay, with external human, with external other than human, and with mental object. Okay, so external human. We, in our minds, we make up stuff about each other. You do not know, even if you know somebody really, really well, you don't know what's going on inside them. You don't know what it's like to be them. You didn't live their life. You haven't had all of the experiences that make them who they are. But we run around on the planet acting like we think we do. Oh, I know. That's Dan. That's Richard. That's, you know. I know these people. I know their stories. I know why they do what they do. But you don't. We don't. You know, there's certain kinds of familiarities and intimacies we can develop with each other, but to really, really, really know. And yet, we treat each other as if we know, and by doing that, we actually make each other into objects, onto which we then impute our interpretations of who we think they are, and we treat them, and we make up their motivations, and we behave in accord with our own story about other rather than ourself. And they suffer and we suffer because of that. Have you ever been made an object by an other? Have you ever had that experience of somebody saying stuff about you and you're going inside you, that's not true? You know, that hurt. It's painful. And to just grind our noses into it a little bit more, I mean, it's painful. It's also the core of all of these really awful ways that we treat each other. It's under racism, you know, it's under sexism, it's under all of the homophobia, you know, transphobia, any way that we take a class of people or a type of person or a race of person or whatever our differences are, and we fix a bunch of attributes onto them, and then we treat them not as the tender, sweet, gentle, complex, imperfect human that they are, but we treat them as this other, right? So that's the kind of real profound suffering that comes from this subject-object. Okay, but we also do it with the other than human world. You know, oh, that's just a tree. Oh, that's just a cat. Oh, that's just a river. You know, and that kind of subject-object separation is what allows us to be defiling our planet and allows us to be doing things that species are dying off that will never come back. And the climate is changing, and all of these things are happening because we've made this beautiful world into objects that we can consume, that we can pollute. You know, it's just garbage. You know, we don't have to worry about that. Or we cut ourselves off from, it's just a tree. But what if it's a home for birds? What if it's a home for insects? Like, have you ever actually gone in and really looked at who lives in a tree and imagine what their life is like? You could really get into that, but we wouldn't know that because, oh, it's just a tree and we walk on by. So these are some of the ways that we suffer from this subject-object making. And we do it with our mental objects too. You know, our own thoughts. We concretize our own thoughts. We beat ourselves up. Those things we do to others, we do to ourselves too. We believe our thoughts about ourselves. Oh, I can't do that. I'm not that kind of person. Or, you know, I'm stupid. Or I'm ugly. Or nobody loves me. You know, we make thoughts into objects and we suffer because we believe them. So this is the primary suffering of the subject-object dualism. And I propose to you that when Dogen says that we have the opportunity to be actualized by the myriad things, he's telling us we don't have to have this kind of obsessive mental objectifying reality be how we use our minds. We could use our minds to actually open our eyes and look around and consider being in relation with that which is not my obsessive mind, with that which is not me. Can you imagine? Go out into the world and have a relationship with that which is not you. That's liberation. So this line, being actualized by the myriad things, is actually nested inside of this the teaching of this very thing. He says to study, this is in the Genjo Koan, and he says, Dogen Zenji says, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. So this is exactly what he's saying is, yeah, we need to study ourself. You need to study your mind. Study that mind. Become intimate with the soundtrack in your head. Your tendencies, your habits, the ways that you objectify self and other. Become so intimate with it that you're not its you're not its victim anymore. You're not just its puppet. You're actually somebody who can step back and be a little self-reflective. Oh yeah, wow, I do that. Study this self. But we don't study it to then aggrandize it and be really excited about it and to run around and preach it. We study it to forget it. Let it go. Study it. And then not even forget it. I have a friend who likes, she says, we study the self to go beyond the self. So that's another way we could think about it. Study it really hard so that you start seeing that it's empty of self-existence. It's just a story. And there's so much more. There's so much more to be perceived and to be felt and to be thought even than this little narrow box of self-referential subject-object activity. See through the limited stories of the self and open to the broader realm. And then, of course, we get into trouble because then we try to talk about the broader realm. and it's actually inconceivable. So, but we try to talk about it, and so there's a lot of words that we use in Zen to try to talk about it. We call it the inconceivable, or we call it the one bright pearl, or we call it the language of the insentience. These are all terms maybe you've heard from this Dharma seat. Radiant light, right? I mean, big mind, Buddha mind. I love this about Buddhism. You know, even though it's impossible to talk about, we still try. Because we want to be free. We want to be free from this small little petty thing that we hang out in. So can we actually forget that self and open to be actualized by the myriad things? That the content of my life, that the content of my thought could be more than my own narrative, that could be the myriad things. So even though one could say that my experience that I had of talking with the rocks and the cactus was pure delusion, I like to think that it's, well, maybe, but you know what? It feels really different to sit and be with a resonant other, be it human or other than human, and rather than put my story onto it, to actually just sit and listen and watch and attend to, who are you? What are you? What are you in relationship with? It's a very, very different experience. And, you know, like if we do that with each other, very different kind of conversation to be with somebody and then, you know, ask them a question about something and then listen to what they say. And rather than listening to make your next point, actually listening to with curiosity, with not knowing, listen to understand, find out more. Oh, really? So you're saying this because you think that? Oh, why do you think that? Go deeper with them. To me, this is a way of allowing ourselves to be actualized by the myriad things with humans, is to allow for this unfolding relationship to be what begins to create our participatory consciousness. This is participatory consciousness, consciousness that happens through participating and through engaging with each other. If this is sounding a little bit, oh, and I realize I don't have a clock, of course. I never bring a clock. Can I have a time check?
8 minutes after.
Okay, thank you. I realize that, oh, thank you, and you always do this. You always hand me the clock, and then I go, oh, thank you, Kokyo. Oh, before I say what I was going to say, I want to bring up one more quote from Hakuin, another one of our great ancestors, because I think it's a beautiful, beautiful example of a description of this experience I'm suggesting to you about the aliveness that of consciousness that's available when we can allow ourselves to open up beyond the limitations of our individual discursive self-referential mental activity. And it's a quote I've used before that I just love how he talks about it. Beata turned me on to this when I came back from Tassajara, and I was describing my experience there of feeling this real connection with the big world, and she shared this teaching with me. This is Hakuin. He says, when your activity of mind is exhausted, when you have fully studied yourself and forgotten yourself, when your activity of mind is exhausted and your capacity for feeling comes to a dead end, if something should take place, not unlike the cat springing upon the mouse or the mother hen hatching her eggs, then in a flash, great livingness surges up. I'll say that again. So when we allow our activity of mind to be exhausted and we allow our emotional turmoil to kind of play itself out, kind of come to a dead end, something could take place that is not unlike the cat springing on the mouse, pure instinct, non-thinking, pure body instinct, or the mother hen hatching her eggs. And then in a flash, great livingness surges up. He says, that is the moment when the phoenix escapes from the golden nest and the crane breaks from its cage. Zen imagery. So much poetry in Zen. So beautiful. But if this is sounding a little bit woo-woo to you, I want to give you a very practical example of this from good old Kosho Uchiyama, who really has a way of bringing it down to extremely practical examples. Driving your car. That he uses in a commentary about actualizing the myriad things. He actually uses this as an example of what that might mean if we think about it. So, this is Kosho Uchiyama. He's a late 20th century Zen teacher. The teacher of Shohaku Okumura. Those of you who know the various lineages, he was Shohaku's teacher. So he says, driving is not done by thinking. It is awkward and dangerous if we drive thinking about what we should do every moment. When we actually drive, the scenery, which is always changing, is the content of ourselves. We forget ourselves and operate various devices with our hands and feet in response to the changing scenery. Our life driving is the same. This is to forget the self and being actualized by the myriad things. Like car driving, we act as one with the scenery, which is always changing. I don't want to ride in a car driven by a person who separates himself from the changing scenery and operates the car with his thinking mind alone. It is very dangerous. Such a person cannot drive a car with vitality. When we talk about Buddha Dharma and the Buddha way, we are talking about interpenetrating life itself as it actually is. So, what a great example, because we all, I think we can relate to that. When we first start driving, of course, we're thinking constantly. Remember that feeling of, you know, uh-oh, especially if we had a clutch. Oh, my God, okay, here it comes. Slow down. Oh, no, left foot, clutch. Okay, which one? Oh, no, here it comes. Oh, no, there's a cat. You know, there's so much thinking that we have to do. But then gradually, as we practice, we do it, our body just sort of know. We just move with the machine, and we're just responding. We're being actualized as drivers just by the world as it is presenting itself to us outside of our cars. So he's suggesting that we can move through our lives a little bit like that too. Stop overthinking it and just allow yourself to be actualized by the myriad things. Another example was told to me by a student recently who said she had her first experience being soku, which is in Sesshin, our meditation retreats, when you, it's the person who manages the serving, you know, the pots and pans and getting the food to the people. And so it was her first time, and oh yeah, of course, there's checklists. So at first she was really, really obsessed with her checklists. And if you've been a soku, you know that checklist, right? You put it up on the bulletin board and you're like, okay, now let's see. Oh, I'm supposed to take in the gamashi. Oh, now I'm supposed to walk around with the towel. Oh, now I'm supposed to take in the pot. You're all worried. Oh no, I'm going to miss something. But she said after, you know, she did that for a little bit and got some correction and some feedback from some of the senior people in the room, she said she all of a sudden she started to have this experience of all she had to really do was feel the room, and she knew what to do. Feel the room. It's like driving the car. Feel the room, and I know what to do. I know how to do this. To study the Buddha mind, the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. When actualized by the myriad things, body and mind of self and other drops away. No trace remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. I've heard it said that you could just study that your whole life. The complete teaching is there. So when we're actualized by the myriad things, body and mind of self and other drops away. No separation. There's no me and there's no you. There's no self and there's no other. We're just moving together That's, I think, part of why we love our Zen rituals is, you know, when the meal, when it's really happening and the soku is really feeling the room and everybody's just doing this thing and we're eating. It's just, it's this beautiful, just unfolding feeling of non-separation. We're just serving and eating. Give or receive or gift. You know, that's another one of our Zen phrases that speaks to this non-separation. You know, if you're really involved in a process of generosity and reciprocity, you know, the giver is not the giver without the receiver. Without the receiver, there's no giver. And vice versa, and the gift. So giver, receiver, gift is all, it's all the same thing. I think that's why we include that now in our meal chant, that phrase. So, body and mind of self and other drops away. No trace remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. Catherine wrote that on my Rakusu, no trace of enlightenment remains. I think because she thought I grasped a little bit too much to ideas. And I think I probably did, probably do. She wanted to make sure I remembered that, so she wrote it on my Rakusu. Because we don't even want to attach to our enlightenment. We got all excited about this and think we're something special and, oh, good for me. I know my Dogen and aren't I great? Shh, let it go. Oh, isn't this beautiful? Self and other. No self, no other. Body and mind is dropped away. Oh, isn't that great? Let that go too. Bokusan, Nishiari. These are commentaries from the Genjo Koan where I found some of these beautiful quotes. There's a couple of really good books about that. He says, we're continuously going beyond. Trace of enlightenment, that's like the boundary of realization. Let it go. Don't abide in the place where you are enlightened. Plunge in and work secretly like a fool, like an idiot. It's another one of my favorite lines. That one's from Dongshan. Like a fool, like an idiot. I think I like that because, you know, when I'm out there talking to the cactus and the rocks, I feel like a fool. And excuse me, I have a leg cramp. Yeah. I feel like a fool. I feel like an idiot.
Really? And,
Oh, yeah. So in addition to talking to the rocks and the cactus, there was one point where there was this beautiful, big, huge, like, I don't know, about 20 foot tall, big, black, dead, bush tree thing, and it had this really compelling center that looked really dark, so I got down on my tummy and I scooched myself in and I stuck my nose down and I was like looking into this dark portal in the ground, right? And I was just totally tripping on the visual blurry perception falling away, and I had this thought, if somebody came by down this trail right now and saw me, this old gal on her stomach in the dirt with her nose in the bush. I mean, I thought it'd be over, you know, it'd be all over.
Well, that's their problem.
So I do sometimes feel like a fool, like an idiot, but it's fine. I think it's okay. I'm not so worried about that because I have my Dharma companions who say such things that we plunge in and work secretly like a fool, like an idiot. But there's, you know, there's so much joy in living this way. So there's, you know, that beautiful metaphor of the, you know, the happy fool, the free fool, you know, the one who's dancing on the edge and just, it's so beautiful. Come out and play. Come on out. Come on out of your prison. If you can. You know, some people can't because they're in real prisons, but most of us are in prisons of our own making. So come on out. I think I'll close with another quote from Norman and then open it up a little bit. We have some time for any comments or questions. And I'll do a slight promo. We each had the opportunity to pick a theme to focus on in a kind of a mini practice focus this year. Kokyo worked with Radiant Light, and I forget what Patrick's going to do in the fall, and Jean is offering a class in a couple weeks looking with a precept practice. And I thought, well, you know, what is my offering? And I know it has to do with mountains and waters. That's what I always end up teaching about, so I might as well focus on that. So I've been studying Dogen's Mountains and Waters Sutra. Boy, that's pretty tough, but I'm doing it. Anyhow, in the process of beginning to study that so I can teach about it this summer, I found a good podcast that Norman Fisher talked about mountains and waters. So this was one of the things he said, and this was in reference to Dogen's words, but it's self-standing. He says, "The physical world is not just physical. It is a world in consciousness. It is consciousness. Everything in the world is alive and is expressing and exerting its life by being as we are." I love how he switched that at the end. He's talking about the world. Everything is alive. Everything is expressing and exerting its life. A great livingness surges up, says Hakuin. Everything is expressing and exerting its life, says Norman, by being as we are. So, anybody want to say anything? Yes.
It's. I don't think it's a mystery what I'm pointing at here, but I think it's good to clarify and remember that the idea of dropping body and mind away doesn't leave a vacuum. There is an awareness. There is an intelligence that you're talking about that can have great joy, great passion, great compassion, and so forth, that exists. We're simply allowing it to come forth, as you said.
Yeah.
But, sometimes maybe someone can hear the idea, we dropped away body and mind, and so what was left? Nothing. No, not nothing.
Yeah.
Something very alive that's actually, maybe is a mystery.
Yeah.
But can laugh and be entertained and things poignant and so forth.
Of course.
That's important to just hold and know. Oh,
thank you.
We're not escaping the world.
We're dropping our concepts. We're dropping our stories. We're dropping our separation. And we're actually great livingness.
That's right. That's intelligent and aware.
Consciousness.
Funny, humorous.
Yeah.
Touched by everything.
Yeah. Aliveness, presence.
Yeah, that's a great place to be.
Yeah.
And that goes back to one of my, that really just aligns with one of my favorite koans, which is an appropriate response arises from
yes.
And let go of all the things we think we are or have to be and all the yada yadas.
Thank you for...
And let the appropriate response arise by itself.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that term in, that response, kan no doko, is the Zen term that we have for this sense that there is a response. There's a relationship.
A way to allow it to arise.
Yeah, there's a relationship there. In fact, I think I brought... Yeah, right. I did bring. I thought if this came up, kan no doko means to respond to each other, and doko means true relationship. This is Suzuki Roshi. So responsive communication is the way he translates that term kan no doko. Interrelationship.
Is that from the sutra, or where's it?
It's just a commentary of his about the term kan no doko, which is one that I've really love because it brings in this thing about response. And so often, you know, we have these questions, what'll I do? What'll I do? You know, people, we always want to know, what am I supposed to do? And it's like, well, open up.
There's a Christian way of saying it, which is be still and know.
Yeah, exactly. Open and ask and then shut up and listen. Something happens. Something.
Don't beat up the actor in the process. Just let them go.
Right. I know that was a strong term. I have a good friend who doesn't like to hear the word shut up, so I apologize for saying it. But I think sometimes I have to say it with myself because that little inner, that narrative, that roommate, there's this really good book I'm reading called Untethered Soul, and he calls it your roommate. It's like, if you lived with somebody who said to you all the things that that little voice in your head says, if that was your roommate, what would you do? You know, you'd boot them out. You'd evict them. So I sometimes have to be strong with my roommate and say things like, shut up, but I realize it's a strong word. Yes.
Thank you, Kathy. This is really vibrant. Offering tonight, thank you. And it makes me think about, and I've said this before here, the Martin Buber's I and Thou, and his whole offering was that it's about turning, is the first thing, as you did, to the Saguaro cactus, addressing, which is asking the question as we do with each other, listening as the third one, and responding. And I think what I'm beginning to understand, think about a lot or feel is how often I respond sometimes without those other steps, you know, the culture is responding, missing out of what is it responding. And so we get into this like actions of stuff when we haven't fully even learned how to ask the question, what is going on here, really?
Yeah.
And the scientists are trying to ask some of what is going on here, the inquiry, and how important that is in my head, in the culture, but, you know, not skipping the listening part. And, man, do we need practice, which is why I really appreciate the, you know, just the gift of sitting.
Yes.
Because it is that opportunity to listen. And then it's, it unfolds in my daily life.
Yeah.
The
ability
to turn, to ask the question, to listen, and then the response feels more authentic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think this beautifully said, and this sense of deep listening, which feels even, you know, I think of it from here, you know, there's the listening up here, which seems more like, oh, what are they saying and what do I think about that? But if I'm listening from here, it's slower, it's maybe less verbal, there's maybe a little emotion in there, I'm attending to the energy, and then there's a different quality to what I actually even hear. Not just listening to their words, but listening. Well, we did this with the second course. It was called Counsel and Mirroring. And we were mirroring each other, and we weren't just mirroring, like, repeating words, but we were mirroring emotion. We were mirroring movement. And it was a really wonderful experience of listening with a fuller repertoire. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
When I saw you yesterday, where I was talking about being too busy and letting go of things, the element of patience, I'm not quite sure where that fits in here, but the element of having some patience, having some time to be able to develop patience, to be able to listen, you know, the not being so busy with so many things. Okay, now I'm going to listen really hard. I'm going to have some quality listening time. And I have never been a believer in that. I've always thought that you need some quantity, and sometimes quality happens. So I'm not sure where in there the patience, it seems that are the allowing time and to develop this, you know, having it open.
I think it takes time. And we have to make that time. And I think we make that time by being clear about what's important. And if we encounter each other in passing in the hall or in the patio or in the supermarket, and we come, can we attend? How deeply can we actually attend to each other?
Right. Well, and so a lot of our attending really does happen in those encounters. And if we're so busy in the grocery store that we don't have 5 minutes to stop and talk to somebody, what does that say about the quality of our life, really?
Yeah, it's a challenge, I think, that we can all practice with. How do you want to live?
Yeah.
How do you want to live? What if you never saw that person again? And the truth is, you may never see that person again. We may walk out of here tonight, and there may be somebody here that we never see again. So if we really live that way, how are we going to attend to each other during tea? You know? What if tonight was it? What if this was the last time we saw each other? What would tea be like? It's time for tea. Yeah, I wish I'd left more time for discussion, because I'm really enjoying your comments. So if you have things you'd like to say, I'd love to hear your comments as we drink tea. Thank you.
Greetings are with us. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma is our godless. I vow to enter them. Buddha. Possible. I vow to become it.